Well, everybody, welcome to episode 101 of my podcast. And today is to celebrate the 101th, because we didn't want to celebrate the 100th, because that'd yeah. that'd be bourgeois. unpredictable. We have Mark Thomas, somebody. Hello Mark. So explain yourself, really. Name, rank, and regiment. Young man. I don't know yet. I mean, take us through your naissance as a comedian. When did you? Who were your cohort, or how did you get started?
I got started partly because of you.
Oh.
Well, no, I did. This is complete true, and I've said this all. I've said this throughout just about every other interview I've done. My mate had a copy of CAC, which I still reckon is the greatest comedy album.
Thank you.
It's fucking excellent. And I listened to that, and it was like, I was like, this is what you can do. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't have to. Because for me, all the comedy heroes I had, right, before listening to that were like Peter Cook, who I loved, right, Dudley Moore. I used to go and see like the last remake of Beau Geste, you know, with Spike Milligan and all that lot. Right. I loved the Goons, and I loved, Milligan was the first comic I saw as an actor. I saw that we went on a school trip to see Treasure Island, and Milligan was Ben Gunn.
Right.
And it was at the Mermaid Theatre.
All right.
All of us were just captivated by the way, jeez. And he just had this fantastic manicness. So I loved, like, my mate used to get, his uncle had all these Hancock and Goons albums. And he used to do a sort of tape recording, so he used to sit around and a little gang of us that were just rejected in every other area would sit around and listen to this. I really loved Stepturn Son and Dave Allen. You know, David, I'll tell you what it was, the currency in our house. I've told this story before, I'll try and give you the abridged version. When I was, my dad was quite a fighter, he was quite a brutal. We used to call him the punching preacher. He was a street preacher down in Clapham Junction, as well as being a self-employed builder. And so rude, it was unfucking believable.
Rude in the sense of socially abrupt rather than...
Oh, no, I mean, just like no barriers whatsoever. No barriers whatsoever. Jeremy Cardi came round to my house once and my dad was doing some work around there. And I got some of these little carpet swatches, which I was just using as kind of like pads, you know, little coffee things. And my dad sits there and goes, these are your cock pads. I was like, oh, dad. Do you know what I mean? It was like no barriers whatsoever. It was, and that was the nicest bit, right? He once, oh, I can't tell you. He had no barriers. That's all you
That's
need.
That's quite an upbringing. Who was he preaching for then? He was in
a he was a Wesleyan. So he was we used to go to a church called the Thomas Memorial, which is a church of the Nazarene down in Clapham Junction.
Right.
And there was a lot, so it was like big white
rooms. Can you unpack
that
a bit? What's all that mean? It's like you just said, we went to the church of the sausages.
Yeah.
It's a Wesleyan.
What's a Wesleyan?
Have something as decadent as a sausage.
It's a bit like what Linda was in.
It was a white walled church.
But just to interpolate a bit of Marxist theory into this, I mean, all these Protestant groups came after the were in a sense proletarian group. They were the religion of the industrial worker, and the main difference it's always seemed to me between is that you know, Catholicism, the priesthood handed down the. Interpreted the message of God because it was in Latin, whereas all the Protestants interpreted the book, the Bible themselves.
Well, yeah. I mean, that as was the Wesleyan tradition is about proselytizing.
Really?
So
right.
it's the word. Right. And you get out and spread the word. So we used to have, as a kid, like they always used to encourage kids to get up in the pulpit and do poems or stories or
it's quite austere kind of aesthetically, wasn't it? They didn't go into
No, there was, you know, there wasn't a huge, it's the joy was that we were going to die and go with Jesus.
Yeah, rather than the earthly pleasures.
Yeah. And
the
so
Sagrada
Familia. My first gig, I was four. I read an A.A. Milne poem in the pulpit. And so my dad used to preach down in Clapham Junction, and that was the Wesleyan lot. They're still there in Clapham Junction. And then as my dad started to make a bit more money, we moved towards the Church of England.
So that was kind of where we ended up.
But we started out as the sort of Wesleyan end of it. So my dad was quite, he would always kind of have this, he always took me by surprise because he could always quote bits of the Bible, and he couldn't read and write properly. My mum used to sort of taught him to read and write properly and used to check all the invoices. Because my mum just going, you've offered someone 15% disso, cunt. Like, you can't do that. You can't do that.
I mean, Linda always says I was raised as a pagan, really, because the religion was completely irrelevant in our house because my parents were communist, which is, of course, a kind of religion. But I feel sorry that I don't know the Bible because, in a sense, it is the foundation of our culture, isn't it?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think if you look at... I'm a big fan of the late, great Christopher Hill, whose work on the sort of radical groups, the historian whose works on the radical groups like of the English Revolution, like the Levellers, like the True Levellers, the Diggers, the Fifth Monarchists, all of that was it's like you get, for me, it has kind of direct parallels between the emergence of the Soviet Union and the English Civil War. You find this book, you get to read it, and suddenly, bang, nothing is the same.
Well, we start with a fucking book. Yeah.
Says the man in front of loads of them. But it's for me, it was really exciting reading all of the stuff, finding out about the Diggers, who are, you know, proto-communists.
Yes, indeed.
You know, 200 years before Marx did the Communist Manifesto, Gerard Wynne Stanley is digging up plots of earth. This is absolutely remarkable.
But it's also that process. I mean, the revolutionary process whereby you get a united uprising and then somebody rises to the top who's a kind of, who then murders all the real idealists, don't you, like with Cromwell?
Well, indeed. I mean, you have the church over at Putney where the Putney debates took place, which is where the Levellers, who were the first people in England to formally call for democracy, right? For universal, well, it wasn't quite universal suffrage because it was only for men, but it was for men to be able to vote.
Yeah.
They had a manifesto. It came out of the New Model Army. The soldiers had their own manifesto. They voted on it. They voted a whole load of people to represent them and uphold the manifesto. Mm-hmm. That was the first time that happened. And suddenly they turn up in a debate with Cromwell, who says, no, it's only if you've got land that you can vote, because then you'll know the value of the land. You'll love the land. So that was, all of that is really exciting. And yeah, there is a direct tradition, especially with Methodism.
Yes.
You know, where you have that whole, with the link with Methodism that goes back to kind of like the Tolpuddle Martyrs, you know, which is really exciting, that link that actually... Well, Lord Soper, do you remember Lord Soper, who was the Methodist bloke in the House of Lords?
Vaguely, yes.
He was always down Speaker's Corner talking about building heaven on earth. Mm. And you kind of go, do you know, I could get behind this. If I had half an inclination to believe,
that's
I could get behind this.
Yeah. We haven't got to your career. We've been going for an hour and we haven't got to the start of your career. No,
the thing was, because my dad was like, he was proper bruiser. And he always used to hit the kid. You know, it's just like a very, very intense house.
Right.
And the one place that didn't have that intensity was in front of the telly with Dave Allen or Step 2 and Son. And this is all true. My dad used to come back from the work and he used to have his bath in the morning. So he'd spend his evening in his work clothes. Lucky us. Huh. And he had this pair... He wouldn't take his work clothes off, but he had this favourite leather armchair that he wanted to watch the telly in. So what he'd do is he'd drop his trousers and used to sit in his armchair with his trousers around his ankles, laughing at Step 2 and Son, like, for being common. And if anyone rang the doorbell, you'd hear my dad go, oh, put my fucking trousers on. And that was... So for me, there's a story about that goes to, I watched Steptoe and Son. Me and my dad used to watch Steptoe and Son together because it was like something that you could bond over. My dad loved Dave Allen as well.
I never got Dave Allen. It's funny. I could see that. I don't know. I think somehow I was maybe like a. I never found him that funny, really. I appreciated that the style was different, but I never found him.
I saw him. He did this thing. I hear what you're saying. Mm. I saw him do this thing in front of an LWT audience, where he got up and he was being me, he said, I tell Irish jokes, and I get into a lot of trouble for telling Irish jokes, but I'll tell Irish jokes. I can't stop you having a laugh, can they? You've got to be able to laugh to yourself, don't you, Greg? If you can't laugh to yourself, what's the point? I'll tell Irish jokes. Crowd completely behind him. Two paddies leave Dublin, go to work in London. The IQ of Dublin halves overnight. Crowd laugh, clap. Turns to them and goes, they get to London and the IQ doubles and there's silence. And he looks at them and just goes, now I thought we'd agreed. And it was like, caught them square on the jaw. It was magnificent.
Yeah.
But the thing about Steptoe and Son, there's one gag.
I love Steptoe and Son, and the pathos is...
They're sort of trapped in this codependent relationship where they can't break away, and there's a little bit of them that doesn't want to, but a lot of them that does.
Yeah.
And I remember watching it. It was when VAT had just been introduced, right? And so he goes, when is he going to visit us? Who are you talking about? The Prime Minister, what are you talking about? VAT, what's that? Visiting all Totters, right? And that was the gag, right? And Totters, as we know, it was you know, rag and bone, scrap metal, what have you. And my dad used to collect all the scrap metal from the building site. So it was like every copper nail he would pick up. Every 6 months, we'd go down to scrap metal merchants that used to be where Chelsea Arbor is.
Really?
And we used to, every 6 months, we used to take all the scrap down. And it was just brilliant. And I, as a kid, it was this amazing place.
Yeah.
You'd go into this one of those old brick kind of like railway sheds. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And there'd just be a wall of car batteries sort of fizzing away. Once we went and the car crush was on fire. Right? The car crush was on fire. And my dad, this bloke standing there, and my dad goes, what's happening? He said, well, somebody didn't take all the petrol out of the tank. And what's happened is, bang, it's all gone up. And all you can do is stand around, have a cup of tea, and wait for it to go out. Because it's all, you know, it's pneumatic technology and hydraulics and all of that. So I said, you just call the fire brigade and wait for it to go out. And my dad said, how often does it happen? He said, every time I've got a hangover. And it was that kind of amazing place. So I remember talking to I saw this bit. My dad got called out because all the sort of self-employed builders used to do their business on the doorstep. So after tea, if you're a builder or plumber or what have you, you know, people used to come around and go, can you come and fix it? And you'd have a little conversation. Kids were banned from the doorstep because it was business, but it's also adult talk, you know. And my dad went out to see a guy called Jim Darby, who lived across the road. And I saw this gag on Steptoe and Son, and then came running out to the doorstep, and my dad went, come on. And I said, when's he going to visit us? He said, well, I said, the Prime Minister. And Jim Darby went, what are you about? I said, VAT. He said, VAT. I said, visiting all Totters. And Jim Darby went, you got a right one there, Colin. And my dad let me stay on the doorstep.
Oh.
Because that's like comedy, has the power to break tension and dissolve that kind of heated atmosphere.
But it also gets you into a place you're not allowed.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You're suddenly, you've got privileges, you've got acceptance.
Yeah.
So that for me, those were the first bits. And then I just started getting into kind of, like, I loved Woody Allen movies.
I just adored them. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember seeing Annie Hall for the first time with my mate and thinking this was the greatest film I'd ever seen.
You couldn't see how he did it in a way, could you? I mean, you could see the early films because they're just kind of vaudeville, aren't they, really? You can see his roots in the kind of being a writer for Sid Caesar and all that stuff. And Annie Hall.
In Bananas,
stuff,
where they're slipping on the skin. Yeah. It's perfect. It is vaudeville. That's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, this wonderful slapstick. But then you get these scenes where Diane Keaton's trying to, is it in Sleeper, where Diane Keaton's reenacting the Jewish family gathering, trying to bring him back from, you know, into the world.
Right.
And those are just, they're great scenes. And you can, I think you can see this little move as he starts to nudge it. And you hit Annie Hall, and it's just like, fuck, that was brilliant. Every bit of it. Every little bit of it.
It's amazingly clever.
You know, there's wonderful bit. There's a, I always remember they're splitting up and they're sorting out books. And he said, is this one yours? He said, if it's got death in the title, it's yours.
So Woody Allen. And
So Woody Allen.
And those records, did you listen to those records? Like the great one about the deer hunt.
I shot a moose. And it's just the most perfect beginning for any kind of routine.
Yeah.
Beautiful stuff. And so I used to love all of that stuff. I loved Hancock, loved Spike Milligan. You know, I thought he was, I want, you know, the Q series, you know, the theme music.
Yeah.
That wonderful discordant
piano. I had problems with that as well.
Did you not like?
I thought it was self-indulgent towards the end. The later ones, the Q, the early ones were better, but then he just, people were letting him get away with anything, I thought, in the later ones.
Mark Steele told this story, and I don't know whether I should tell it you because it's Mark's story.
I think it's all right. As long as you accredited.
It's Mark's story. He was a policeman in one of the sketches, and he had to come along and go, move this sketch along now.
Right.
And Spike Milligan and one of the actors had to, there was a sketch where they'd sit down facing the audience, and in front of them was a telly that the audience couldn't see. And they would just start laughing, and they would laugh and laugh and laugh, and the audience started to laugh, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And when you thought it was going to stop, they carried on, and the audience dipped. Then they went up again, and then the stage revolved, and it was a test card, right? Okay, so not great, but you entered this, the process with that one. Mark said the director came along and said, really sorry, there's a technical fault. We're going to have to take it again. And Spike Milligan says, well, you can't do that again. You can't take that again. What the bloody hell? So just cut it. So they go in the corner and they chat and they say, right, we'll do it. So they came back, they sat down, the director goes, action. And they sit there crying. And for that, for the invention of that,
right.
You go, that's genius. That.
Well, he was. I mean, he could be a genius. I just, I don't know. I think the early series were good, but I just thought by the end he was just spinning his wheels. But we're not here to talk about me.
We're here to talk about you.
So those were the ones I liked. And then I went to Bretton Hall, which was an arts college.
Yeah, do you think they closed that down just because it was such a repository of working class talent?
I think it was an amazing place.
Extraordinary.
It really was an utterly brilliant place.
Yeah.
My best mate
it's
is
now college the, or uni.
It was a teacher training college, wasn't it?
But it was connected to Leeds Uni, so you got a Leeds Uni degree, right? But you also got the benefit of not going to university and going to a college.
The history of Bretton Hall is really it's a beautiful place.
Undiscovered. It's in the grounds of a Capability Brown landscape.
It's now the Yorkshire Sculpture Museum.
Yeah, it's now the Yorkshire Sculpture Park. And you had 800 students there. And like, so John Godber was the year above me who wrote these incredible plays that were just about working class life in Barnsley and in Yorkshire. Mm. And and he now runs, you know, the Theatre Royal in Wakefield, which is just a great, great place. And with just this, I love the fact that you've got this incredible working class, or you've got quite a mix. Yeah, you know, there was a middle class, but it was a very working class sort of like group of students there. And my best mate, Pete, he was from Wakey.
Shaky Wakey.
And he always used it, Wakey born, Wakey bred, strong in arm, thick in head. You know, and he had this whole kind of, his dad was Sparks. And we used to do these shows at the Labour Club. Right, because it was a really exciting place.
Because we should say just that the most conventionally successful alumni of Bretton Hall are League of Gentlemen.
Yeah, League of Gentlemen, without doubt, are just, you know, they're incredible. But there's a whole load of really interesting writers come out.
When they shut it down?
It was about 10 years ago. Something like that might have been a bit earlier than that. But, I mean, it's... Leeds basically decided to move the entire thing over to Leeds, so they didn't want it out near Wakefield in the middle of the countryside.
Right.
And what I loved about it was also you just became... What I liked about going to college was for the first time you were with a whole group of people with a like mind who had a... It didn't matter. You could stay up all night arguing over Bertolt Brecht, and that was great.
What were you supposedly studying?
I was doing theatre arts.
All right.
So I did... I was obsessed with musical and with Bertolt Brecht. Right. So that was my...
Not unconnected, yeah.
And no, indeed not. And they used to, because Theatre Royal, before it reopened, it was just derelict, right? The Wakefield Opera House, derelict. And I wanted to write my thesis on it because I thought I'll go to the Wakefield Press and I'll get all the microfiche, as they were then, of all the old kind of like playbills and see who was on and see if you can track who was on, what nights were on, and then look at all the prices, look at national average wages, and do you know what I mean?
Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
And do quite an academic study.
Yeah.
And so I asked the caretaker if he'd let me in. And it was all chipboard, like padlocks. And he opened it up and it stank, it was like musty. All the chairs were backed up against one side of the wall. There's pigeons, there was rats. Do you know, it was shit. And this guy just got this little look in his eye and he pointed at the stage and went, "We booed Charlie Chaplin off of there."
I just thought, what a fantastic thing. There were 3 hours in now and still not got to your career.
I'm sorry. So
you used to do shows at the Workmen's Club.
We used to do, yeah, so we did shows at the Red Shed, which was a socialist club, 47-foot long, drill hot.
Right.
And it was the place that everyone used to go on to pay their subs, the union subs.
And this in Wakefield, right?
Yeah. So everyone would go to pay their subs. So the place was packed.
Give us a time frame. When was this?
This was in 82 to 85.
Okay.
And so when we had this great Greek Stalinist who was the barman, who just went, we had this incredible sort of Yorkshire Greek accent. And if a Wakefield like city councillor, like a Labour councillor came into the bar, he would just harangue them. And if they try to pay with the 20 quid note, "What the fuck am I, Barclays Bank?" He was fantastic. He came up to me once and said, "Mark, are you your Trotskyite? A man has until he is 21 to become a communist." And then sort of moved away. But so he had all these sort of different people there. So, and especially during the miners' strike,
right.
We fed 150 families from that club. And do you know, I look back upon it, and I didn't feel proud then, do you know what I mean? I just felt we were part of, it was just what you did. You just got stuck in, you know, and that was part of the struggle.
We didn't do, I'll just point out, we didn't do that sort of thing at Chelsea School of Art. That was not a locus of socialists.
Did you not have a happening for Marx?
No, we didn't. It was very, yeah. No, I mean,
We used to write these plays. Like me and my mates used to write these plays. And, well, they were sort of sketches, really. And we would write them in an afternoon and put them on the next day. And we always used to say we refused to rehearse because it was bourgeois. And so we would just, these really improvised random sketches.
Right.
And there would always be benefits and fundraisers, right? You know, whether it's nurses or the ambulance, nurseries, miners, what have you. And at the end, Byron, the barman, "Give a round of applause for the students." And it was kind of like everyone was really nice. And we were sort of part of that gang. In fact, I still keep in touch with all the people who are mates there.
Oh, wow.
And I adore them. Do you know what I mean? They're proper comrades. And so that informed me hugely. I always thought that when people took the piss out of the miners' strike, when I came back to London and started on the comedy circuit, I was like, "What do you mean you're taking the piss out of the miners' strike?" Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It was like, no, you don't take the piss out of that. That's fucking workers' struggle, that is.
Mm.
And so that's where it sort of started. And I phoned up just club owner. I got a copy of Time Out and City Limits, the magazines, looked up all the clubs, and they all had the phone numbers of the clubs.
Right.
And I just phoned them up and said, can I do 5 minutes? And they said, well, have you done it before? And I just went, yeah. And so I had a whole load of gigs booked in.
Wow.
And it was really easy back then to book in gigs.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's just go back a bit and just let's talk a bit more about the effect of my album on you. I was, it was recorded in a really interesting way. I mean, I did manage it. It was a terrible prick, but he did. We took the big studio in Basing Street, you know, where they recorded Live Aid, and we converted it into a club for two nights. So you had the recording equipment, which then obviously wasn't very so we had all this really professional recording equipment, yeah, which it would have been impossible to take to a club. It still sounds like it's recorded in a bucket, as I recall, but
other day I was walking along and I saw a street artist and I thought of the line, they call them bit bap or snot and they come from fucking Guildford or something, you know, and it was like those bits of that album have stayed with me. I was always amazed. Because I always described you as like, you know, John Cleese said that Peter Cook was the gatekeeper to the field that we all play in. And I've always said Alexis Sayer was the bloke who kicked down the door of the squat. Do you know what I mean? It was like, that's what it felt like.
I agree
like
with you, yes.
It felt like that what you had done is you just ripped up the rule book and rewritten this thing.
Yeah.
And for me, the stream of conscious swearing, just the fucking about the playfulness of it.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, oh, I understand why he gets on with Robin Williams. Because the both of you just... fuck up. There's huge discipline. There's huge writing. There's masses of skill, but there's a degree of play and fuckery that goes with the audience that both of you have, which I find really exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that enough?
So I think we've done you now, Alexei. I think it's back to me.
Jeez, I think we need another minute or two, actually.
No, that's fine. No, it's not. I mean, but
go on. That's really, yeah, it's true. Kak is fucking splendid, fucking stupendous.
I just sort of now, I don't know how I did it, really, or, you know, I had that confidence of youth, I suppose, to do something that was so radically different, really.
But I got a photograph of you brandishing a gun in a pub in Ladbroke Grove.
Yeah. That's the unlucky gun. I've told the story of the unlucky gun, haven't I?
The shotgun. It's not the sawn off
shotgun. It's not the shotgun, no. It wasn't sawn off, it's just a shotgun. No, the story of the unlucky gun is that it was a replica of a 1911 Colt. It was an air pistol that I bought afterwards very quickly.
I've not heard this story.
Oh, really?
No.
I got it off the catalogue because Linda was Littlewood's catalogue and it didn't work properly. I didn't pay for it properly, so I think it attracted bad karma. One night I went down the Elgin and did that act, which is like a quiz, but I pointed the gun at people. And they all laughed, but I forgot they were all on heroin. So, and then I went, that Saturday, the Comedy Store, I wasn't emceeing for some reason. I was having a night off. Then I got drunk on whiskey at home. I said, I'm going to go to the Comedy Store. I'm thinking that they'd welcome me, but of course it was a different audience every week, so nobody knew I was the regular MC. So I came on stage, screaming at the audience, drunk, waving a gun at them. And this is a tip that I give to all young comedians. Don't point an authentic-looking gun at an audience, because I want you to all listen to this, because it makes them nervous, you know. And I just died terribly on my arse. And that was the night that Rick and Aid also turned up. So, and there was a journalist in from The Observer. It was the first time that the press were. So I thought my career was ruined. So that's that gig at the Elgin, which must be in 1979, with that sketch going down really well with the gun, yeah.
And with Tony Allen.
Yes.
We had a gun in my house. You've just given me a flashback, and I've been sitting here cringing, thinking how I could have so died. My mum used to do Amdram, Arabic Amdram, so Aramdram. And she did a play once where she had a revolver and she shot someone, but it shot, and we had this canister, this little thing full of blanks.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if it was a real gun or not, but you could shoot the blanks and it made a fucking loud gun noise, yeah? And it was in the attic up in my house. And when I was home alone, I was like a fucking 9-year-old, I would go, because I was so obsessed with this gun, and I'd get it and I'd load it and I'd walk around the house like shooting the cat, like shooting myself in the head, and like, I don't know if that could easily go fucking wrong, because
you put a fucking question mark there.
I don't know, because it's blank, so I just thought harmless.
Brandon Lee. But if something else had got into the barrel, yeah, you could have killed yourself, yeah.
And like my neighbors.
I think the real threat is that you did it in London.
Yeah.
As a person of colour, and you're fucking dead by the police.
Yeah, shit.
Oh, to carry on the story of the unlucky gun.
Tiny boy.
Also, so Rick and Abe, then when I got to know them better, they borrowed the gun for a sketch where they held the audience hostage, and that died as well.
Then the audience hostage.
Then the gun was stolen from the squat or council flat that they shared in, I'm just going to say, Kennington. The gun was stolen, and the bloke who stole it used it to hold up a post office and was shot by the armed police. So it was the gun's fault. It wasn't my fault. It was the unlucky gun, yeah.
Are you blaming the gun on the bloke's death?
Yeah, obviously. It's
okay, no, that makes sense. That makes sense. Now you've said it like that.
Yeah, it was an unlucky gun. Well, I'm also blaming my failure that night. Anyway, yeah, sorry, carry on.
But we once did a play with two Palestinian performers, and in it we had a replica AK-47, which gets used for a minute, you know, in a tiny little scene. And fuck me, we had to have a secure box, it had to be padlocked, it was, you know, you could... We were trying to get into the north of Ireland with it. It was fucking
I can imagine, yeah. I played a Hezbollah general in some TV show once, and the armory guys, they take it so seriously. And this gun never fires in the scene. No bullets in it. He's like, you can't hold it up, never point it at anyone. It's like so strict. And it fucking feels really heavy, and like some of the photos I got are pretty bad.
And you see, that's why Lee Marvin, who's one of my favourite actors, he was, because, you know, he served in some
US... First Marine Corps, had his bottom shot off
Did he?
Saipan, I think.
There's stories of him just showing like actors how to strip a gun and just clean it and keep it working and all that kind of stuff. But he was also an advocate of gay rights and a supporter of the Democrats. So he's kind of like gone,
yeah.
You know, it's like Lee Marvin. Yeah, okay, you're cool.
I worked with him.
Did you?
Yeah, Gorky Park.
Oh.
He died directly after I killed him.
Was that another unlucky gun?
This podcast is not really about me, but I'll tell this story. It's
called the Alexis L podcast.
I'll tell this story. So, in the film, I end up being shot in the head, and what they did was they put a explosive charge on my head and then covered it over with a kind of false skin. And I had to set it off, but the effects guy, I didn't put any protective backing behind it. I know. Fuck. And he was very... I should have known when because he was missing three fingers, so...
Fuck.
I should have known.
Yeah. Yeah, explosive experts and carnival roustabouts. Missing fingers.
Yeah. But so anyway, I did it. And they made me do it again. And they didn't use the shot in the end. But I think this was that. So they put... I had the earplugs in, you know, like just simple earplugs. And then the makeup just kind of painted them so you couldn't see that they were in. I was sitting in makeup. This is absolutely true. Lee Marvin kept very much to himself. He was very ill then. Hadn't spoken to anybody. The greatest actor in many ways of his generation, I think, better than Brando. Or, you know, he came into the makeup truck, sat down and talked to me for half an hour, telling me, spilling his guts about whatever, you know, and his experiences in the Marines. I couldn't understand a fucking word because I had these earplugs. Absolutely true. So I just sat there going, yeah, blimey. that happens to me. Lee Marvin talked to me for half an hour.
Shit. And you don't know what he said?
I have no idea what he said.
But he talked to you for half an hour.
But he talked to me for half an hour. He liked me. But I never spoke to him again. He died soon after.
Sorry. There's something brilliant. I did a film recently.
We've now got 6 weeks into this podcast and we haven't got your career.
We're actually going to have to eat you before we come out at the end of it.
I offer myself as sacrifice.
I did this film over at, do you know, Sand Studios over in, what do you call it? What's it? Near, around the back of Greenwich. You know, it's Rotherhide.
Yeah, it's, yes. Oh, yes, I know that. Yeah,
you know, and it's a great costumier.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But they've also got a, they've got a film studio there, and they've got, it's great. They do an art club, an art cinema there that's pay what you can. And so you get kind of Cuban films on, or you get Humphrey Jennings seasons and all that kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean? It's brilliant. Anyway, they've done a film about the Beveridge Report, and they filmed it there, and I was the narrator, and they had sort of Miriam Margolyes and all that kind of stuff. But they filmed there. I didn't meet them. They were all sort of by themselves doing their bits. But it was a fantastic place, and you always sat around. They had all big communal tables for lunch. And I got talking to this old guy. I finished a little bit early. And I got talking to an old chap there. I just thought, I'll go and just say hello, get a cup of tea and having a chat. And we were talking about films. And I said, who's your favourite director? And he said, I'd have to say Sidney Lumiere. I said, really? He said, yes. He said, when we were making Murder on the Orient Express, he got Albert Finney and Vanessa Redgrave and Sean Connery, all of them together, and said, the last thing I want you to do is to come and ask me for motivation. Your box office stars, go and do your work. And suddenly I realised this bloke was Richard Godwin, who produced all this amazing... And you know when, you, when you're in that presence of someone and you just went, tell me everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was... He would just tell you these. I'd always, when we finished early, I'd try and find him out. He just said, "Well, you know, cinema's just a history of fuck ups, really. It really is." So a friend of mine worked on Casablanca, terrible time. Humphrey Bogart was on punishment for being drunk on another film. Ingmar Bergman, they didn't really rate. And the film script had been on the shelf for 2 years. By the end, they'd run out of money. And the last scene, the famous last scene at the airport, they couldn't get a full size plane onto the studio lot. So they got a small plane and filled it with midgets. You can see them if you look carefully. And it was like, just all these little stories. Yeah, yeah. You go, I just want more. Yeah. They're wonderful, those people, telling those
yeah,
stories.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So anyway,
yeah,
your career. Oh, yeah.
So you're getting 5 minute spots in London. That's where we got up.
Yeah, yeah.
So and who was your cohort then? Who were the people who...
Well, I used to, the first person that I gigged with was Andy Johnson, who was a tortoise impersonator. He was absolutely remarkable. He used to impersonate tortoises, and if he got booked to do a long set, he'd get two teeth strainers, put them over his eyes, and do a B as a filler for 10. And he was absolutely great. John Lenihan, who was the magician, he was there. And then it was kind of like, they were on the first bill that I ever did. But for me, it was people like Kevin Day and Jim Miller. They were the people that I wanted to hang out with. Bob Boynton, you know, Nick Revel. Lee Korns, I love. Lee Korns and Nick Revel.
They Lee were... Korns was there in the opening night at the Comedy Store.
He was fucking great as a compere.
Yeah, was he? Yeah.
He was fucking brilliant. I loved working with him. So all of those folks, but I, what I loved, and you'll be able to speak to, what I loved was there was this kind of, there was a world that was being assembled that was rejects of another world.
Right.
So you had street performers who just didn't want to work in the winter. You had club singers who couldn't get club gigs. You had speshacks.
Speshacks.
I loved speshacks. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. They were, do you remember, there's a speciality. So you'd have like paper Terry Carroll.
Right.
Right, do you remember, there's a paper tearer. And she used to come on and she'd blah, 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 and suddenly she'd have this fucking ladder coming out of these bits of paper. It was just remarkable.
Whoa.
She was just great. You had
really
a
really like kind of specific skills.
Well, I mean, or anything that's not stand up or music is a special. So jugglers, acrobats, especially.
But you had people like Steve Murray, who was like the teddy bear torturer. And he was fantastic.
I don't know anything about this because I'd left this world because I'd gone. So rapidly from the Comedy Store and the comic strip to television and then playing
well,
the big room.
Steve would come on, and an enormous bloke. He looked like sort of like Tommy Cooper's brother who'd done time. He was enormous. And he'd just go, look at this! and bring out this massive furry squirrel. Look at this! They sell this to children! They sell it to children! And then he'd press a button and a flick knife would come out the tail. They sell it to kids!
That's just better. Yeah.
And he was brilliant.
He'd built this, presumably.
He had one bit where he'd get little Ted out and he'd tape him to a record turntable.
Yeah.
So little Ted would be on the turntable. He'd press the button, it would spin round. He'd bring out a set of darts and go, "The Wheel of Death!" Throwing these darts at little Ted.
I've never heard anybody ever mention any of these acts except you.
I have to promise you, Steve Murray was great.
He also had
a guillotine for a teddy bear with just blood that went everywhere. You had all sorts of acts like that.
Prop comic, we'd call it.
No. You would have heard sort of like Alex. You'd have heard of the Iceman.
No.
Yeah.
The Iceman used to melt a block of ice.
Yeah, I've heard
that was
this.
His gig.
Oh, yeah, vaguely, yeah.
He used to come on with a block of ice.
Yeah.
And he used to try, he'd get 20 minutes to melt it.
Right.
And he'd have a file, he'd have WD-40, he'd get the audience to blow on it, he'd get a blowtorch. Each block of ice was numbered.
Right.
And at the end of the 20 minutes, he'd go, "Block 33 has defeated me." And he was
where the fucking hell was this stuff going on?
Well, it's just going on in all the clubs and stuff. It was like happening
Jongleurs
all over the place. Not at Jongleurs.
No,
that was proper. Yeah. But what was great was he's now an artist, actually, and there's a documentary coming out about him.
Really?
But I loved it. It was like a homage to the myth of Sisyphus. Do you know what I mean? It was this great one. And he would... Sometimes audiences were just like, "What the fuck is this?"
Yeah, but it is an elision of performance art and stand-up. I mean, that was another thing that I did was like, because I'd been at Chelsea during the birth of performance art, that I very consciously brought that into.
But that
the cabaret sphere, yes,
was thrilling. Like the Kipper brothers,
Are you just making this up?
I promise you,
the Kipper brothers.
One of them was, I think, married to Karen Finley. Karen Finley was a New York performance artist who got banned from the ICA in Westminster for inserting yams into a bottom while reciting radical feminist poetry in a performance art piece called Yams Up Your Grands.
Right.
I remember telling Jeremy Hardy about this, and he said, "Were they tinned?"
That's your question?
It is, but I mean, all of the... I remember... What was great, there was a comic who I won't name who was very, he was from Manchester and he was very smart, he had a proper suit and he was like, "I'm in show business, I'm in show business, me." And he did this gig, you might remember Tony Green, who was an anarcho, who was a part of the original store.
Bob Flagg, yeah.
That kind of era.
He did the original... alternative cabaret night was Bob Flack, yeah.
So Tony, like, I remember going to see his romantic other was one of the strippers who worked at the Nell Gwyn, and I saw her. She had an act where she started naked and then would put clothes on.
Right. That's like Marina Abramovich.
You know, it's all that kind of...
Turn that into a multi-million.
So you had that whole kind of... you had all sorts of different... Like the Kipper brothers. Let me get back to the...
Back to the Kipper brothers.
I remember them finishing an act in this pub called the Pearly King in the East End. And they're both standing there naked with little panda bears taped to the penises. And this bloke from Manchester going, "This isn't fucking show business."
No, he's right there.
The only place you see this stuff now is at the drag shows and the burlesque shows, really, that I've experienced. And really anarchic, experimental, hilarious shit.
And you had Jim Barclay as well, who was kind of like, half and half.
Yeah, but he was, kind of alternative cabaret alumnus. Yeah.
And he was a lovely bloke.
Yeah, it was very nice, Jim. And member of the Communist Party as well, I think.
Was he?
Yes.
He was very... What I liked was you would always get people like...
And now manages his daughter, who's a comic, doesn't
I
think.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. I can't remember her name. I don't know if she's called Barclay as well, but a few years ago I saw him and he was like driving air around and doing air bookings and what have you.
He's a lovely fella.
Yes, he's very nice. One of those people who hasn't changed.
One of the comics who I loved most was Bob Boynton.
Again, after my time, really.
Bob used to come on. He was great, was Bob. He used to work on the... he was shop steward on the railways. And he worked on the track. And he led a strike. And he told me, he said, my slogan was, I'm a communist, but I'll never go bent on you. And that was what got him elected.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
He led a strike. And after they lost the struggle. And... Bob was put on a team of strike breakers. And he said, I just fucking got out. Because it's like someone doesn't shout train and you're...
Oh, right, yeah.
So it's like you want to get off that
team. Yeah.
So he used to come on stage and he had this suit on. He had all these sovereign rings. And the audience used to think he was a character comic.
Yeah.
And he used to come up, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Bob Boynton. I'm a communist, Marxist, Leninist. Look, my comrades say to me, Bob, football's a proletarian sport, but it's not, it's motor racing. Motor racing's a proletarian sport. A few quid to get in, lovely sunny day, couple of beers with your mates. If you're lucky, you watch some rich fucker burn to death. That was his opening gag.
Yeah.
And you just go, I love this.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And then I suppose people like...
Never seen him on Live at the Apollo, as far as I can...
I think he was shortlisted. No, he wasn't. He used to have these occasional bouts of brilliance where you'd see sort of old school joke writing skills.
Yeah.
There was a time where this was a topical gag, right? He said, ladies and gentlemen, Reggie Cray has announced that he's found God. He's found God, ladies and gentlemen. He said it took him 25 years to find God, but he's finally found him. I'm not surprised it took him 25 years, because if Reggie Cray was looking for me, I'd be fucking hiding it. And do you know what I mean? It was just like fantastic. So people like him and Claire Dowie, who I loved, who's just this remarkable, beautifully honest performer.
Know the name, never seen.
So those are the people that I liked hanging out with and just sort of like seeing.
And then did it get bigger for you? Did you end up playing the big rooms or?
Well, what happened was,
because you had a sort of parallel career as a kind of activist slash. I mean, you're on Channel 4 almost every week, weren't you? More or less.
I did. We went and did the telly show, which sort of cut. Well, the first I did sort of stuff like, you know, down the Paris studios, the old Paris, which is just fucking great place.
I love the Paris. Yeah.
I remember seeing Lenin of the Rovers record.
Yes, that's right.
Great
yeah.
Great place.
Yeah, you used to get terrible electric shocks off the microphones.
But you'd walk down that stair and there would be like Hancock and Sid James and they all, you know, this incredible sort of history of the place.
Oh, it was lovely.
And
is it gone now? I've not
seen it.
Paris Club.
No, it was called the Paris Theatre. It was Palace, a BBC owned Paris.
It's on Lower Regent Paris. Street.
Right, okay.
Was it on Lower Regent Street? Yes. It was, wasn't it? Right down towards the parks in the Mall. And it was, so we did stuff like the Mary Whitehouse Experience and stuff, you know, topical radio stuff. And then it was, I got offered the thing to do. Oh, it's very funny looking back on it, because I just thought, oh, fuck. We did a thing called Viva Cabaret, which was a Channel 4 series, and it was different compares. Like, there was... three compares and we took turns. And it was me, Lee Evans and Lily Savage. I kind of feel like I've let the side down. And it was, and they were all great.
The Mary Whitehouse Experience, so that was you, Rob Newman,
Badil. David Badil, Steve Punnett and Dennis, Skint Video, Joe Brand.
Right.
Now, the Skints were great because Skint Video were this musical comedy act. Yeah. And, Brian Mulligan, Steve Gribbin, and Steve Gribbin's still performing. And they first, I used to love it because I used to tour with them and they were the first people I toured with. And we'd go over to Belfast and do these gigs and they were just fucking great.
Yeah.
Electric gigs. And you just thought...
Yes, lively audience, Belfast audience.
Oh, we did
in the
this.
80s.
Oh, they were. They were amazing. We did this one gig on a pub on the Ormar Road. It was a nationalist pub. It's the first time we'd ever sort of done a gig in Belfast, and the Stickies turned up from the markets, which are the Marxist wing of the IRA, for a works night out. And it was really exciting. I loved the kind of the political charge.
Of course.
Yes, I mean, I never really realised it until I went back later, but there was a part of Britain where there was government death squads.
Yeah.
There was a revolutionary armed struggle, you know, whatever, you know.
No, it definitely was a revolutionary armed struggle.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because you have... there was an occupation, you had a fucking internment.
Mm.
You know, you had... the Shankill Road butchers who were working hand in hand
with
the security services.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this was absolutely remarkable.
Yeah, and yet never. I never in a place that looked like Stoke, as it were.
That's super Stoke with the giant causeway.
Well, it looked like a northern town, didn't it? You know,
did.
Midlands town. You know,
and it was. I remember going. What I loved about it was I went there 1 year and there was, and we did stuff like we'd go and do Eamon McCann's Arts Festival down on the bog side and stuff like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And it was thrilling being there.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
just
the
hearing,
sense of danger. It was
but
there.
Hearing voices that yeah. you wouldn't hear.
Yeah.
And not accents, but hearing those views. I remember sitting in Derry and people said, young lads going, just saying, when this is done, we need a Truth and Reconciliation Committee. We need to have a commission to look at it all.
Enough,
and actually I was going, fucking hell, this is amazing. We've got people thinking.
Yeah. It's funny how little it affected the mainland, as it were, Britain. I mean, it's not...
Don't call it the mainland.
that's a bad thing.
All
right. Britain. Britain.
So it was... I think you're right. None of that, the roadblocks, the checkpoints.
Yeah, it's troops in the middle of the fucking street.
Yeah.
I mean, this is incredible to me that I was talking to, we used to stay with this this lovely family who used to put us up, and she was a teacher, the mum was a teacher, and a Republican. And so when she used to get stopped at the roadblock, she just used to go, I'm not helping you at all, you just get on with your business, and get a book out and just sit on the side, just read. And just all the troops would carry on the search of the car. And I remember meeting, one of the persons who was very important to me was meeting David Irvine, who was a loyalist. And David Irvine was, what happened was, he was the guy who formed the PUP, the Progressive Unionist Party.
Right.
Right. Really interesting group. And they were the people who condemned the harassment of Catholic schoolgirls by a loyalist community.
Right.
Right, and saying this is a dark day for unionism, went up against his own side, da 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 da. Interesting bloke, because I did a gig, and as I was being driven from the airport to the festival, someone said, who's impressed you politically? And I said, David Irvine. He said, would you like to meet him? I said, that'll be a laugh. I'm doing the sound and mic check, and this guy comes in the room holding up a phone, going, Mark, it's David Irvine on the phone for you. And I picked him up, and he's got this really kind of, you've just bounced into my life. What exactly is it you want? And I just automatically said, I wondered if you'd like to meet for a cup of tea. And he said, tomorrow. And gave me the name of this hotel.
Right.
And so we met, and he was, and what was really interesting was him talking about the class dynamic of the loyalist community. Right, and that was fascinating. And that he made this journey while he was in the maze. And he said he realised that all the Republicans were doing doctorates, were in the library, and all the loyalists were in the gym.
Right.
Right, yeah. And it was like, fuck, why don't we have any emphasis on education?
Right.
And he started to go, it's because we're entitled. We just think we're going to get the job at Harland and Wolff. So we don't have to do it. These guys have to do it. And so he started to educate himself. And he had this wonderful thing. As an autodidact, he was known as sort of like, never use one word when there's 10 available. Do you know what I mean? A man who loved language. And he talked, it was an old Marxist Republican who he used to talk with.
Right.
And he was the kind of loyalist Gerry Adams that led to the peace table.
Right.
And to get the kind of loyalist gunmen to the peace table is a deal.
Fuck yeah.
Because if you fuck up, they're still loyalist gunmen.
Yeah, they don't play those motherfuckers.
You know, and he wasn't a nice guy. Right. He didn't start out as an... He was arrested. He said, I was arrested for trying to take a car bomb into a Catholic area. And so I was handcuffed to the bumpers while the... And the police... All the soldiers thought he was IRA.
Right.
Because they're all paddies, aren't they?
Yeah.
And he said he was handcuffed to the bumper while the bomb squad arrived.
So jeez.
Not a nice... Yeah. Guy, allied to Gusty Spence, do you know what I mean? The Red Hand Commandos, all that shit.
Yeah, I mean, all we've got left over is that TV series, Blue Lights, which is, and the, you know, which kind of touches on, but it's not, it's just extraordinary how that none of that has really came over here.
I find it incredible
here.
How it didn't touch us.
Yeah.
It didn't touch us here. It didn't touch us, we weren't aware of it. The war wasn't here.
No.
Until, you know, a bomb went off.
Bomb, even then, I mean.
But that wasn't, you know, you had that amazing thing where, like, there'd be a warning on the tube and everyone would just go, all right, just hide around the corner.
Yeah.
You know? And so it was this incredible, you know, Ireland was England's first colony. That's what it was.
Yes.
You know, that's a remarkable thing. The Anglo-Normans in the 12th century. You know, they Dublin got its name from the anglicisation of the Viking words, which made Dublin, which was Blackpool, which is where the two rivers met and formed the Blackpool. Okay. I think the actual, it was originally called the Bridge of something. It was like, I've forgotten the name. Basically, the Irish of it is Ballyacleet. That's what it would be called.
Right.
So you've got this complete takeover of a country, the complete takeover of a country. You know, the hunger brought in, you know, by the fact that the English forbade.
Yeah. It's not because, I mean, that Netflix series, House of Guinness, all the actors are fucking English. I thought, I was watching a trailer about it. I thought just because they're unknown actors, I thought they'd all be, you know, taken from the streets.
This advert's going on a bit.
Yeah, they're all fucking
Is
English.
It just the big Irish Guinness advert?
James Norton. Yeah, he's an excellent actor, but he's not Irish. I was on, sorry.
I mean, Derry Girls. And the kneecap.
No, they are all Irish.
I know, but that was a...
Kneecap, a fucking
great. Kneecap movie. Then have you seen the movie as
I love it.
Fucking outrageous. So good and brutal, isn't it?
I thought it was really funny because actually what was brilliant about it was lots of it is a very similar format to music films.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? A group aren't quite a group, but they show talent. They're brought together. They make it, but then they get into trouble. And you know what I mean?
It's Summer Holiday or whatever.
Do you know what it's the Blues Brothers. Do you know what I mean? We're going to get the band together, you know.
Yeah.
But what was brilliant was just the playfulness with that culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
And and that wonderful line, I'm a Brit. God, not you. I mean the MI5 and the security Brits. It's fucking great line. But the point for me was it was a real badge of honour to go to the North and perform. You know, it was a thing we'd go all the time. We'd do as many gigs as we could there. And I absolutely loved it. I thought it was thrilling. And the voices, the different politics and that reality was really thrilling.
Yeah, and then you're on the television all the time, and now you're here.
Yeah.
And that's it. Thanks, man.
Now, you come up in conversation a lot with me and Alexi, and you've been a guest we've wanted on for quite a while, because you, Alexi, have been... What are you digging? What are you rooting around for?
Looking for me.
Pills for your nerves?
Oh, pills for me nerves? No, I'm looking for me Glock.
Oh, fuck off. Don't point it at me. It's
now,
blue.
Just tell me, is this lucky or unlucky?
Oh, this is it's neither. It's an airsoft, so it's powered by canister of air. It's not loaded. It's the exact weight and feel of a proper Glock 17.
Who's the most famous user of this gun, would you say?
The Glock. First time we saw the Glock really was the same.
I've broken it.
It's a fucking
Glock. Oh, no, I've seen it.
There you go.
I had to use a glass.
You need to be, if you're going to be working on my podcast, you can very.
I could strip this in 14.3 seconds.
And yeah, you need to really use a Glock. We were introduced to the Glock in the second Die. The first Die Hard film brought us the Heckler & Koch MP5, and then the second one brought us the Glock, Die Hard 2.
Right.
The first time it was, because he talks about it being made of ceramics and it going, which it actually doesn't, but not being able to be detected in a metal detector. So.
What's the difference between the Glock and a Beretta?
Made by different people. Well, there's other things as well. I mean, this Beretta's got an external hammer.
Beretta's. The third Die Hard, right?
No. Anyway, Lethal Weapon. The Beretta is the main character in the Lethal Weapon series of films. Mel Gibson uses a Beretta Model 90. Both, they all load 9mm. Sorry, where were we?
Everyone needs a hobby.
Yeah.
No, because you've brought up Mark Thomas a lot, because if you remember maybe like 30 episodes ago, in that kind of era of the podcast, you were really curious about exploring the idea of how you use politics in comedy.
Yes.
And Mark was...
So
I thought that could be a nice topic before we... Especially in today's climate, Mark.
Well, I think there's something really interesting.
I mean, because you were a kind of unique illusion, weren't you, of kind of campaigner and comedian, really, in a way that I never was, really.
But it was also, there was that little bit of Bretton Hall.
Right.
That was about theatre and was about story and about how you tell a story and how you campaign and create the narrative of it. And for me, that was always really important. When we did the telly programme, right, it was like Channel 4 were actually great at that point. They were really good. Mate, well, you know, when they... Literally, we would go, we want to take all the money on the last programme and bet it on a horse. And they went, okay. And it was just like... And that's what we did. We bet it on a horse and lost. And we filmed the last programme from my mate's living room. You know, and it was just like we wanted to play and fuck about with it all. You know, for us, it was about that. You've got this telly program. You can play with this. And that's when we did all the stuff with, like, the conditionally exempt works of art list, which is, if you inherit a work of art, you get to put it on this list and you don't pay inheritance tax. But you have to let the public in. And we found there was, like, billions on this list, but you couldn't know who had it, where it was, how to contact them, how to arrange a seeing. We all had a right to see it. We'd paid for the right, but we couldn't actually activate it. So we found out Nicholas Soames had a 3-tier mahogany buffer with partially reared slender baluster upright supports on the list. And we said, can we come and see it? And he went, make it a secretary. So we went and organised it. And the day before the visit, we phoned up and said, look, I've been talking down the pub. And you wouldn't believe how many fans there are of the 3-tier mahogany buffet with partially really slender baluster upright supports. Can my mates come? And he said, well, how many? I said, 20. He said, no. If they want to see it, they'll have to make individual appointments. So he got 300 people to make individual appointments. He fucking put it on display at Christie's auction house. He said, there's no filming, there's no camera, there's no photography, right? Because he didn't want us to put it on the telly. So we all turned up there. We had a courtroom artist, a charcoal sketcher. We had an oil painting. We had an etch-a-sketcher. We had pipe cleaner modelers. We had plasticine, every form you could think of. And then he took it off the list, right? Well, he started saying people can't come and see it. And so we were doing all this big campaign on it and sort of like going to various places, finding out who had what on the list, you know, pushing us, you know, looking for clues here and there. Organising mass viewings, and they actually changed the law on it. And I was walking through, the house of Portcullis House.
I know it.
So I'm going through Portcullis House with this MP after a meeting. We've gone through, and I see Nicholas Soames sitting in a corner, and my legs have started moving before I've sort of engaged. And I've just sat down in front of him. Nicholas Holmes said, yes. I said, Mark Thomas, John Ford, remember? He said, yes. I said, you've got free Tim Mahogany Buffet, partially really send about Robert. Said, yes. Have you still got a year? I hope you're taking care of it. Yes. I said, you don't let people in to see it anymore. Is it because you paid the tax? He went, yes. I was like, 5 years. Five fucking years for that punchline. Do you know what I mean? But there was this moment where we just thought, we can play. We can really fucking play. And it got to the point, because like we were, there's one show where we found out that Labour's great left-wing torchbearer, who had written a book, and in his book he said there's no greater sign of inequality than multiple home ownership.
Mm.
And it turned out he'd got fucking 12.
Mm.
Right? He had 12 homes that he was buy-to-let, and he was renting them all out.
That's a lot of homes.
Right. And then if you added in the ones he had with his missus, it was 17. 17 buy-to-lets. Anyway, we kind of did a show about it and it kind of stopped him in his tracks. And I thought, fuck, we've got some power.
Do you think you're the reason they shut down Brett and all that, and that you're the reason why comedy is kind of stupid these days?
Yeah, yeah, it was me.
Yeah, because you made it.
I mean, I think those bits were really exciting because you could feel that change. And I'm not saying that the, look, big change, proper change, we all know happens with a movement. But you can elicit little change and be acts as inspiration and to show that it's not hopeless and actually that there's fun in fucking with these people. You know what I mean? Yeah, there's real fun with that. We were looking at all this funding of dams that were being built in the Kurdish regions. And one of them was by a group called Spibatignon, who are a part of AMEC, or a subsidiary of AMEC. And we blagged our way on as Spibatignon's French head off corporate offices, which had this amazing park on it. And we said, we're ice sculptors. Can we come and build an ice sculpture in your park as part of our art project? They said, yeah. And we built a massive fucking dam with the name of the dam that they were building on it. They came out to see it, freaked the fuck out, all on camera, told us, tried to shut it down, all this kind of stuff. And then we just jumped in the van, drove off, left them with half a ton of ice melting on the fucking lawn. And then, like, 4 weeks later, they cancelled the project. And we're like, we did that with a load of ice.
Wow. Mm. Now, the project was presumably corrupt and also environmentally a disaster.
Well, it was an environmental disaster. And what was happening was the Turkish state was building loads of dams in the Kurdish region that was basically destroying Kurdish culture. Right. And this is in this place where, you know, if you taught in Kurdish or you petitioned to be taught in the Kurdish language, you could be jailed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was absolutely remarkable. We did a whole lot. Part of a campaign on dam building in the Kurdish region, and we hooked up. I was lucky to work with a really good campaigner, and I said, "What do we do?" And he said, "We go to the Kurdish region, we meet the communities, we meet the community representatives, and we ask them what they want us to do."
Yes,
and it was like.
Yeah. Nobody ever thinks of that, do they? Yeah. Really?
Asking, so we literally sat there and just went, "What do you want us to do?" And they just went, "Attack the finance." And so that was our job, to attack the financing. And it was, I just remember feeling hugely grateful that I got a chance to work with campaigners who knew what they were doing and would approach it from the bottom up. Instead of trying to go, we've got a plan for you.
Yeah.
And I love all of that.
Yeah.
Very clever ways of actioning these. You know, led by donkeys are great and whatever, but they project a film on a building over and over. But you're coming up with these creative ways of making the point and embarrassing people. And
I like led by donkeys, but they're all a little bit centrist. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It's kind of like, it's fine, but there's a class dimension here that no one's talking about.
Yeah. And so where are you now? What's bring us up to date? Any projects you want to see?
Right.
To advertise on the,
yeah, plug.
First of all, I want you to go and see a mate of mine called Vic Melody.
Right.
She is a performance artist and an anthropologist.
Are you talking to me or the people that listen to the
podcast? I'm talking to you.
Oh, right, okay.
No, I want you to go. I want you to see it. But Vic Melody is this amazing performer, and I directed her last play. This is what happened. She embeds herself with hobbyists, sticks with them for about 3-4 years, then makes a show.
Right.
So she did a show about pigeon fanciers.
Right.
She did a show about Northern Soul dancers. Right. It's really fascinating stuff. And she came up to see me and she said, and she's really fucking, she put her dog into dog competitions and it kept coming last. So she decided that she would become, as a way of gaining parity with her pet, she would enter Miss Brighton. And she became Miss Brighton. She won Miss Brighton. And then she enters Miss England. And she loses, but she wins every category, like most committed to improving the community, most interesting, most characterful, most... She won all... Do you know what I mean? So she's a fascinating woman. And she said, I want to work with you. And she said, what should we do? And I said, reenactment.
All right.
And so she said... And I was like, here's Christopher Hill. And... She phoned me up and just went, Mark, I've joined the wrong side. I'm a royalist. It was hilarious. She's fucking great. So she does this thing about reenactment at the same time as turning up. We both worked at White Hawk at the football club.
Right.
Doing fundraisers. And what happened was there's a guy there, there's an old fruit and veg market stall holder from the East End, moved down to this estate, right, White Hawk estate. And as lockdown came along, he knew that people were worried. They've only got the Premier. Right, that's all they've got. So people were worried about how they were going to get through lockdown. So he made this little offer going, would anyone be interested in Meals on Wheels? He blags the key from a caretaker for an unused council kitchen. He blags a whole load of volunteers from trade unions, from pensions, people living in the flats, and he blags a whole load of food from restaurants, supermarkets, cruise ships, all of that. He fed 400 people a day from a squatted kitchen, right? And it's still going. And he's now become a spokesperson for a national campaign calling on mandatory Meals on Wheels.
All right.
And I've seen him speaking. He's fucking great. He was up with sort of Danny Dorling. And Michael, I've forgotten his name, but it's fucking great. The guy on health inequality. I've forgotten. I've met him loads of times. He's really fucking brilliant. And he
does. Did I know him? Why would you?
Because he's clever. And he studies health inequality. He's an amazing bloke.
And I think I do know.
So there were those two on. And then Brian from the White Hawk Estate.
Right,
and Brian stands up there and goes, we're spending 22 billion a year on malnutrition. And it's true. This is what the NHS have calculated. It's between 22 and 29 billion. Year on year, it varies. 22 billion on malnutrition. Well, I ain't clever. I ain't done all the science. But I've got a cure for malnutrition. It's called food.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it was like seeing him take this place alive. You know, it was brilliant. And what was brilliant? It was because he was blagging all this stuff from cruise ships. When the rest of the country went into lockdown, this little council estate in fucking White Hawk were getting lobster. They got lobster.
Shit.
And so that's all part of... that's. So Vic Melody's show, you have to go and see, because I'm very proud of that and she's great. I'm doing a play that was written for me by Ed Edwards, which is called Ordinary Decent Criminal, which is all about his time in jail, but it's more than that.
Who's in that?
Me. Just me.
Oh, right.
It's fucking great.
Yeah.
It's a really good play. It's hilarious. We performed it in a jail down at HMP Channing's Wood in Newton Abbot the other day. And it was just electric.
Yeah. It's
fucking great.
Congrats.
Because you just go in there. And I'm sure you've done gigs in jails. Have you done?
No.
The jail gigs are fucking electric. I went in, the first one I did was in Edinburgh, and there's me and a folk band. It was during the Edinburgh Festival. And at the end, all the prisoners who are sort of low category drug offences, they're in dark blue sweatshirts and they sit on one side of the room. And all the ones with heavy sentences, they're in sort of like a light blue jumpers and tops.
Right.
And they're on the other. I did the whole gig to them, whole fucking gig. And at the end, this bloke got up, It was Colin Fox from the Scottish Socialist Party who had organised it. And he said, thank you to all the people who've been in it. It was really important to do a gig here as part of the Edinburgh Festival because this is our community. Whether people out there know that you're part of their community is irrelevant. You will be at some stage, you know, and you are part of their community. But I'd also like to say that with us here in the room is Paddy Joe Hill, who was the Birmingham Six. Was, as you know, Paddy Joe Hill did 14 years. And then when he was released, went back and fought to get Winston Silcott and Tottenham Three released. He fought against the miscarriage of justice. And it's the first time he'd been in a prison that wasn't Work or Nick. And they said, we've got with us Paddy Joe Hill. I fucking swear to you, you won't have heard applause like it outside of a Tory leader's speech in the 1980s. Fucking went on. And it was just went on and on and on. And it was, there was a bloke who had fought what they were in and won. I mean, it came with an enormous price, but he won. And so those gigs I always found really fascinating. And what I found really interesting about going to do them is they just sit there and at the beginning you go in and they go, so have you been inside? And I'm, no. I've had people I know, but that's it. So how do you know about it? I said, well, my mate Ed, who wrote the play, he did 3.5 years for importing cannabis. All right. And you just have to be really honest.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And there was... Yeah. So they said, how do you, I said, Ed and I still go, we worked in various prisons and we'd do writing projects with addicts in recovery. And this bloke goes, so what are you, I said, I'm sober for 10, Ed's clean for 12. So would you go to AA? Well, I did and now I go, so what do you do? I go, there's a counsellor, I speak to him, does that count? And it's just, all of it is like, if you tell one fucking word out of line, one sniff of bullshit, well, not literally, but, no, but do you know what I mean?
No,
but, and it's what I really like about those rooms are the total brutal honesty of it, that everyone has to be honest in that room.
Yeah, yeah, but it's a program of honesty, isn't it, really?
And so for me, going in and doing them, that's great. So we're doing that, and then I'm going to go and do a bit more stand-up, and then we've got a new project, which we're hoping to do, which is a performance piece about Palestine action.
Think you'll get arrested for doing that?
Well, it's going to be interesting if they try and arrest you for doing...
Yeah.
For supporting Palestine action in a work of art.
Yeah. Mm.
It's going to be very interesting at that point, because at that point you're going, okay, where do you want to draw the line?
Yeah.
People can find you on Blue Sky if they want to keep up to date with your comings and goings, is that right?
Yeah, they can look on the website, they can rummage around, I'll be about.
We'll put that in the podcast description, a link to your website.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Can I just say, I will now leave this room and I will go back home and they'll go, what was it like? I said, he pulled a fucking gun on me.
That one distinguishing feature of the Glock, of course, is there's no external
safety. Right, that's been the Alexis podcast.
What you see is
support us on patreon.com/AlexisL podcast.
Trigger.
We don't have adverts on the show. We never want to have adverts. Please go to Patreon. If you want to see Alexi flexing his gun and watch video versions of the podcast, patreon.com/AlexisL podcast. Please chuck us a couple of quid on there. We just dropped episode 2 of Lisa Nigel and Alexi watch The Young Ones. What do you think the chances are of getting you three together again to watch the next episode?
Yeah, why not? Yeah. None of us have got anything up to do. You make my life feel completely empty. All the things you're doing.
Oh,
if you like performed in prison, you know, went did, I don't know, work, you know, stopped a dam.
Yeah. Raised funds for the strikers.
Did something
for
but all of us do that stuff. All of us. No, and also,
I just do, sat here, had a sandwich, watched Netflix, went to bed. You make me feel, played with me gun.
Do you know what I saw recently? Have you seen Lenny in Every Brilliant Thing?
No, I didn't fancy it really. I shouldn't say that. Was it?
Mate, come on.
Isn't it all fucking optimistic about shit?
Ish.
Yeah.
Ish. But it's also...
He didn't invite me.
Oh, God.
Do you need an invite?
Yeah.
To see a friend?
Yeah.
An old friend?
I'm very proud. I don't know.
He's really good, isn't it?
Yeah, he's a very good actor. Yeah.
It's fucking great.
Yeah.
He's finished now, hasn't
he? What I think he has, but what I find brilliant, I always remember you doing the interview on Radio 4.
Because we did that chain
reaction. Yeah. And we did the interview with Lenny, and he was fucking remarkable. What I hadn't realised quite until you kind of put it into that perspective, that he was 16 years old and launched into this world of the British club circuit.
Yeah.
And the only black guy on the black and white minstrel show.
Yeah. That's surreal, yeah.
And yet here he is doing shows.
Yeah, no, he's really, you know, he's saved himself, really. I think
he's got one of the most amazing career arcs out of any British comic. It's absolutely outstanding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's busy as well. But he's doing something right now. But he's doing something important.
Alexei,
right
you're
now.
Doing great. You're doing
not,
really
I'm doing
well.
Nothing.
No, you're writing a book, man.
You are.
You've got a hit
book.
Show on Radio 4 and the best podcast in fucking
best
England.
Podcast.
No best more, no communist more podcast.
And me TikTok videos. You've forgotten those. See me, I have a viral sensation on TikTok.
I haven't seen
on Instagram.
No.
Yeah, what were you, 10 million or something?
Getting there, yeah. I think that's close to
yeah.
it. We'll show Mark when we're done with this. Let's say goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The distinguishing feature of the Glock 17 is it's got no external safety.
Woo! Cuts!
You've been listening to the Alexei Sell podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.